For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week we're bringing you the second of our Booker Prize shortlist specials. Elif Shafak discusses her sensual novel, 10 Minutes, 38 Seconds in This Strange World.
We travel into her story, but also the story of a country, and maybe the Middle East, told through the eyes of outcasts.
Chigozie Obioma reveals the real-life tragedy that inspired his book, An Orchestra of Minorities.
You know, he did this because he was in love with this woman back in Nigeria and wanted to make quick money and then come back and marry her.
And Margaret Atwood unveils her sequel to The Handmaid's Tale.
And also we have the symposium at the end, which makes it clear that Gilead didn't last. So there's lots of reasons not to be optimistic, but about these kinds of regimes, there are frequently reasons to be optimistic because, in fact, they tend not to last.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. First awarded in 1969, the Booker Prize celebrates the finest fiction written in English. Thanks to a long-standing arrangement with RNIB, the Booker Prize Foundation has again funded production of accessible versions of all the shortlisted books, ensuring that members of the RNIB library can join in the discussion. The winner of the 2019 Booker Prize will be announced on the 14th of October. Read On will, of course, bring you the result. But in the meantime, let's meet some of the shortlisted authors. Elif Shafak is an award-winning Turkish-British writer whose work has been translated into 50 languages. She's not afraid of portraying lives that others shy away from, giving voice to those who might otherwise remain inaudible. Her shortlisted novel, 10 Minutes, 38 Seconds in This Strange World, is no exception.
Only a few hours ago she was singing, smoking, swearing, thinking. Well, even now she was thinking. It was remarkable that her mind was working at full tilt, though who knew for how long. She wished she could go back and tell everyone that the dead did not die instantly, that they could, in fact, continue to reflect on things, including their own demise. People would be scared if they learned this, she reckoned. She certainly would have been when she was alive. But she felt it was important that they knew. It seemed to Layla that human beings exhibited a profound impatience with the milestones of their existence. For one thing, they assumed that you automatically became a wife or a husband the moment you said, I do. But the truth was, it took years to learn how to be married. Similarly, society expected maternal or paternal instincts to kick in as soon as one had a child. In fact, it could take quite a while to figure out how to be a parent, or a grandparent for that matter. Ditto with retirement and old age. How could you possibly change gears the moment you walked out of an office where you had spent half of your life and squandered most of your dreams? Not that easy.
Alex Dunmore narrating 10 Minutes, 38 Seconds in This Strange World, written by my guest, Elif Shafak. Elif Shafak, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much.
Could you set the scene, please?
Well, I think I became very interested in these series of medical and scientific studies that show after the moment of death, after the heart has stopped beating, the human brain can remain active for another few minutes. And in some cases, this could go up to 10 minutes. So I wanted to add my own 38 seconds. This idea was very intriguing to me. Right away, we know, as we start reading this book, that the main protagonist is dead. She's a sex worker. She has been brutally killed and dumped in a garbage bin, but her brain is active. And as she remembers her past, minute by minute by minute, we travel into her story, but also the story of a country and maybe the Middle East told through the eyes of outcasts, always told through the eyes of people who have been pushed to the margins of the society and people who have been silent.
And her memories in those last 10 minutes and 38 seconds really add the layers of humanity to her and mean that she becomes far more than just the dead sex worker. She becomes a human being, a person with a background and loves and hopes and aspirations.
Indeed. And this was so important to me. I do not see Leila as, in some ways, she is a victim, of course, of the society, of a very patriarchal culture, and she has faced discrimination all throughout her life. But at the same time, it was very important to me to say, this is not a weak person. She has a voice. And maybe I should also share with your listeners another important motivation as I was writing this novel is actually a real place in Istanbul. It's a graveyard. It motivated me. This place is very unusual. Unlike any other graveyard, there are no names there, no surnames, only numbers. It is on the outskirts of Istanbul, and it's a place reserved for outcasts, for unwanted people. And we call it the Cemetery of the Companionless. And the people who are buried there have been shunned by their families or by their communities for lots of different reasons. So among the people who are buried there are lots of LGBTQ members. There are people who have died of AIDS throughout 1980s and 90s because of the stigma. They weren't given a proper burial or a proper funeral, and they were buried here. There are also abandoned babies. There's a growing number of refugees. We always read about refugees whose boats have capsized, sunk in the waters. But where are all these bodies taken? So they're also taken to the Cemetery of the Companionless. Therefore, it's a very sad place where an Afghan refugee or a Syrian refugee might be buried next to a Turkish sex worker or a Kurdish transgender citizen. And I think I wanted, as a writer, to take one of those numbers and give it a story, a name, an individuality, and try to reverse the process.
Leila's friends, her companions through her life, are also those outsiders who, without giving too much away, are probably destined to end up there themselves.
Absolutely, because they're also people who have been marginalized. They're also people who have been pushed to the periphery, for different reasons. But I think one of my central points is, and I do talk about this in my talks as well, in countries where democracy is lost, it is very difficult to be different. If you are different, for whatever reason, this could be the color of your skin, how you physically look, it could be your political views, you could be a minority member, whatever reason, if you are different, life is very difficult. So I think there's a part of me that also wanted to underline this. And I am someone who very much believes in the need for solidarity and sisterhood and for people to empower each other, especially in those countries where there is no democracy.
I first came across you through your TED talk about the power of fiction and storytelling to transcend boundaries and how we need to be able to step outside the groups that we coalesce into to be able to understand other cultures, other disabilities, other sexualities.
That is true. That is something I sincerely, genuinely believe in. And to me, it's so important, particularly in our age, because we live at a time when there's a lot of tribalism, and I think we're being pushed into tribes all the time. We're being told that we will be safer if we're surrounded with sameness, but I don't think that's true. And I also believe that as human beings, we always learn from people who are different than us. They're the ones who challenge us, who encourage us to think more carefully. To me, diversity is precious. And I come from a country that has lost its diversity, that has never appreciated its diversity. And I sincerely believe by losing that in Turkey, we have lost a lot.
Yes, and I was going to ask, Turkey and Istanbul in particular, being the crossroads between East and West, how has the book been received in Turkey?
I think my answer is going to be mixed because there's a big difference between people and the elite in Turkey. That is why I sometimes think being a Turkish novelist is a bit like being kissed on one cheek and at the same time being slapped or punched on the other cheek. Because from readers, from true literature lovers, book readers, I receive heartwarming messages. And really, there's a beautiful connection there with my readers. that is very important to me, that's very dear to me. But on the other hand, from the elite, political elite, cultural elite, you get a lot of abuse, harassment. Sometimes writers are put on trial, investigated. I have had a taste of that, in a way, when one of my previous novels, The Bastard of Istanbul, was published. I was put on trial under Article 301 for insulting Turkishness. That novel, The Bastard of Istanbul, talks about a Turkish family and an Armenian-American family, and it talks about Armenian genocide, and it talks about memory and amnesia, and the story is told through the eyes of women, generations of women. So when the book came out, the readers embraced the novel, and I had really beautiful, heartwarming feedback, but at the same time, I was put on trial, and in a way, it was so surreal because my Turkish lawyer had to defend my fictional characters, my Armenian fictional characters in the courtroom. So it's not an easy place, Turkey, for writers, for anyone who deals in words. It can be very tough. And maybe people don't realize that sometimes to write about sexuality, gender, to write about issues like sexual harassment, gender violence, can be also very difficult in a country where there is no freedom of speech.
Do you feel that being shortlisted for the Booker Prize, which is an internationally regarded literary prize, has actually taken you to another level of being able to represent those diversities, and that the Turkish authorities are no longer going to be able to say that you are just a troublesome woman writing from London about things that you shouldn't be involved in?
I think they will always see me as a troublesome woman. Writer. However, of course, I'm very happy and very honored to be shortlisted for the Booker Prize. It's an important prize. And also, maybe I should share, being a writer is a very lonely work, you know? You're a solitary creature. I think most of novelists are introverts. I definitely know that I am. So it's a strange feeling. You produce, you write, you think, you read on your own, for weeks, for months, for years. And then when the book is out, when the story is out, you have no idea whether it's going to mean anything to anyone. You just let it go. And so to know that your story, the story you've written in that lonely space, has touched other people's hearts, meant something to them, and has been recognized, is a beautiful feeling. And I think it is important for writers. So I really hope there will be many, many more prizes like the Booker around the world. It matters.
Now, your work has been translated into 50 languages around the world, and I know that you started writing in Turkish, and then your more recent work has been in English. Do you achieve different effects by writing in English to Turkish?
I love language. You know, I've always loved words. To me, it's almost magic. The fact that with a limited number of letters, we can create infinite possibilities. So I think I've never seen language as an instrument, as a tool that I use and then I put aside. For me, it's rather like a continent. I enter into that space and we change as we commute between languages. I think we change a lot because languages have an effect on us. They shape us. I have written my earlier novels in Turkish first, as you said, then I switched to writing in English about 15 years ago. For me, of course, English will always be an acquired language. I didn't grow up in a bilingual environment. I started learning English around the age of 10. And at the time, Spanish was my second language. English became my third. But it never abandoned me. And I love this language. And I felt attached to it emotionally. So that said, of course, I'm an immigrant in this language. You know, I'm a latecomer. I'm an outsider in a way. And I think when you are an immigrant, you always know there's a gap between the mind and the tongue. And the mind runs faster than the tongue. And you always want to say, express yourself better. You know, you always want to crack better jokes. And you can't. That gap is with you. But I think if you learn not to be intimidated by that gap, it's also quite inspiring because it pushes you forward and you have to pay more attention to nuances, to language, to words. And that's what I've been doing. So I think all I'm trying to say is, as I commute between Turkish and English, I feel attached to both languages. Nonetheless, I've realized over the years, if my writing has melancholy, sadness, sorrow in it, I find these things a bit easier to express in Turkish. But when it comes to humor, which is very important to me, and also irony, I find it much easier to express these things in English.
The language that really spoke to me as a blind person while reading 10 minutes 38 seconds was the sensuous language, the language of smell and taste and touch, which is obviously universal, but it's so central to Layla's story. And they are the last sensations that her brain responds to before she dies. It beautifully expresses something that we all feel as human beings.
It's so important to me what you've shared right now, because I also experienced it that way. I wrote this book at a strange moment in my life when I wasn't able to go to Istanbul. And I realized the way I remember the city, the way I carry the city with me, all my memories are somehow always connected to smells, sounds, you know, the taste of maybe street food, or simple things, but this is how we remember. And I think it's incredibly important. Stories are very much triggered by those small moments and smells and tastes. So I agree with you. I think this is how we connect with life, with cities, and with our own memories.
The poetry of the language comes through incredibly strongly in the audiobook narration by Alex Dunmore. Did you have anything to do with selecting her as a narrator?
I was very happy that she was selected. It's beautiful to listen to the melody of her voice. And I love audiobooks. I listen to audiobooks and podcasts all the time. I think it's much deeper, the experience, you know, and in some ways it's more intimate, more personal when we listen to stories. It's just, you welcome that story, you welcome that sound into your soul. And I find that experience very, very personal. So I'm a big lover of audiobooks in general.
And do you know whether there is an audiobook library for blind people in Turkey and whether they will be able to hear the Turkish translation or even the English version of 10 minutes 38 seconds?
Yes, that's a very important question. There have been important attempts in Turkey over the last years. We have a library for blind citizens, but it's very limited. It needs to grow, it needs to be funded, it needs to be supported. I do know that one of my earlier novels, The 40 Rules of Love, has been a widely listened number one bestseller in the Library for Blind Citizens in Turkey. So that to me was very, very important. But I also know that there aren't enough funds, there isn't enough support, particularly when it comes to local libraries. We don't have enough support for that. And it's sad to see, you know, there are so many shopping malls. We don't need so many shopping malls in Istanbul. We need more libraries. And we need investment in particularly local libraries, especially for young people coming more disadvantaged backgrounds. There isn't enough support in that sense at all.
Well, I think that's something that even over here in the UK, a lot of us would agree that we need more funding for libraries. Elif Shafak, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and the best of luck with the Booker Prize.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
10 minutes, 38 seconds in this strange world is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB24909. And Elif Shafak will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Margaret Atwood on why the time is right for a sequel to The Handmaid's Tale. But first, Chigozie Obioma's debut novel, The Fisherman, received international acclaim and was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 2015. His follow-up, An Orchestra of Minorities, has repeated that success. speaking via Skype from the University of Nebraska, where he's professor of creative writing, he gave his reaction to Robert Kirkwood.
So it's a story about a poultry farmer, a lowly and lonely poultry farmer in the early 2000s Nigeria. He's just lost his dad, and his mom died a long time ago. So he's in, you know, kind of depression. And one day, while coming back from, you know, the market where he's gone to restock his flock, he meets this woman about to jump over a bridge and kill herself. And he tries and saves her from that by throwing his two prized chickens in the river. So they get entangled and, you know, they go into this very tumultuous love affair. But the story is narrated by the main character, Chinonso's Chi. And the Chi is a guardian spirit in the Igbo cosmology. So it's a spirit that reincarnates, has been around for like 700 years, and, you know, is believed to ensoul everyone who comes into the world.
Now, was it hard to write it from that point of view, from the point of view of the guardian spirit?
Absolutely. It was something that I had to do. I normally don't do research when I write, you know, but I had to do a lot of research on this one because it's a concrete belief, you know, that undergirds the Igbo, you know, civilization. And it was the reason, for instance, why the Igbo people and most of the eastern part of what is today Nigeria did not have a monarchical system, but an egalitarian structure of government, because they believe that if everybody is ensouled by this divinity, then there should be no need for one person to have sovereignty over others. It's an integral part of this, you know, cosmology.
Now, it's narrated by a spirit, but the event in the book is based on your own time in Cyprus.
Yes. So I the novel was inspired by somebody I actually knew who suffered a kind of a similar fate to Chinonso, the main character. So this guy sold everything he had to go to Cyprus, the north part of Cyprus, which is under the Turkish military regime. And, you know, and then when he got there, he discovered that he had been scammed by these elaborate, you know, fixers in Nigeria. And, you know, so he got very drunk and went to the attic of his building and fell to his death. So in the aftermath of that, he told me just offhandedly that he was, you know, he did this because he was in love with this woman back in Nigeria and wanted to make quick money and then come back and marry her. So An Orchestral Minorities was in many ways me trying to retrace, you know, his journey. The question that was paramount was, what would have been the dynamic between this couple that would have made this guy sacrifice everything he had to be able to return and be with her? So, you know, that's a kind of a journey that the novel portrays.
Is that the JK in the dedication?
Yes, it's the J in the dedication, that's right.
Now, it interweaves African tribal stories with Western tales. How has the book been received in the US and in Nigeria?
Well, in the US, it got like very great reviews, I think. Wall Street Journal called it very original and extra, you know. I was profiled by Time, but I feel like the American readership are, to a great extent, insular. You know, I find that people are not very interested in other cultures, except, you know, books that thrive here tend to be ones that have some kind of American dynamics in it, maybe an immigrant story from Africa. But in Nigeria, it's been very well received. I did a major tour back at the beginning of the year, and people are very happy for, you know, this undertaking, because we've not had a cosmological novel, in a long time, I don't think.
Did you translate it into Igbo for Nigeria, or is it the English version?
We are doing that. That is in the works. You know, Nigeria was, of course, colonized by Britain. So the language of education really is mostly in English. So I conceived my work in English mostly.
Where did the title come from? Is that a Nigerian phrase?
So one of the most frequent scenes that I witnessed as a child that was very profound, at the same time chilling for me, was the attack on the yard chickens we had around the neighborhood by kites and hawks. So these predator birds. So I used to watch them. They perch on the thermal, and they could stay there for like, you know, even an hour, just priming their target, because once they strike, they don't miss. So I always observed that in the aftermath of that attack, when they've, you know, taken a cock or a chicken, what happens is that the chickens just like make this very distinct chilling noise. So there's nothing they can do. They can't even fly. So they just wail. It's a kind of protest that happens. So in the Igbo language, there's a term for that. It is called kind of the crying of the birds. But I took some poetic liberties, with an orchestra of minorities.
Talking of your childhood, I know you read all of your dad's books at a very early age before he enrolled you into the local library. How diverse were his tastes?
He had a very interesting and eclectic mix of books, really. For some reason, though, he was very fascinated with Greek myth and a lot of Shakespeare. He had, ones that I can remember off the top of my head, As You Like It, there was Macbeth. There were like a range of books, and then the Lamb condensed version of Shakespeare plays. So I've asked him why he, was attracted to these books. And the only reason would be that he was born in the 50s when there was still like the colonial presence in Nigeria. So the British influence was really the thing. So these were the books that I read growing up, and some of the early Nigerian writers, Achebe, Wole Soyinka, Tutu Ola, and the rest of them. So I can't remember there being an American author really that, on his shelf. None that I can think of.
Do you think that's influenced your writing?
Yes, unconsciously, of course. You read these things and you internalize the structures. And these days, everybody talks about how I tend to write about, tragedy and all that. And I'm like, well, how? And if you look very well, you could trace it to some of the early books that shaped me, really.
Now, the audio version of An Orchestra of Minorities is narrated by Chukwudi Iwuji, who also narrated The Fisherman. Have you heard either of those books?
Yes, I think that he's an extraordinary reader, especially for The Fisherman. I think that, he was able to do these different voices, and even An Orchestra of Minorities, it's an extraordinary performance as well. I mean, we recorded some things. I gave suggestions on how to pronounce these words. And I think, he did very well, if you ask me.
Now, as I said, it's now available in Braille, giant print and audio. Is that important to you that now it's accessible?
Yes, it is very important to me. As I said, I have the RNIB version of, The Fisherman, and when I heard that you would be doing another one for this book, I was excited. I hope that your readers can listen to the audio, actually. I mean, it's kind of long, but I think it's something that they can access over a week, especially the one from Audible really is good. I would try it.
Chukwudi, best of luck with the Booker Prize, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Chukwu, creator of all, I concede that I have done something out of the ordinary by coming here now to testify while my host is still alive. But I am here because the old fathers say that we bring only the blade sharp enough to cut the firewood to the forest. If a situation deserves exigent measures, then one must give it that. They say that dust lies on the ground and stars lie in the sky. They do not mix. They say that a shadow may be fashioned from a man, but a man does not die because a shadow has sprung from him.
Chukwudi Iwuji, reading from An Orchestra of Minorities, which is TB24924. Thanks to Robert and to Chigozie Obioma. Like all the books shortlisted for the Booker Prize in this and previous years,
An Orchestra of Minorities is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we go back to Elif Shafak to hear the books of her life... Few books have been as eagerly anticipated as The Testaments, Margaret Atwood's sequel to her 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale. Its publication came with a fanfare reminiscent of that given to Harry Potter, with bookshops opening at midnight and costumed characters from the book mingling with fans eager to get their hands on a copy. Details of the novel had been kept tightly under wraps, and only the Booker Prize judges received preview copies. So, everyone was on tenterhooks when Margaret Atwood appeared at a press conference at the British Library to talk about The Testaments for the first time. Read On was there too, so amid a whir of flash photography from the world's media, here's writer and journalist Erica Wagner to introduce Margaret Atwood.
In 1984, when she was living in what was then West Berlin, Margaret Atwood began writing a novel, the premise of which, she has said, seemed fairly outrageous. She asked herself, would I be able to persuade readers that the United States had suffered a coup that had transformed an erstwhile liberal democracy into a literal-minded theocratic dictatorship? The Handmaid's Tale was published in 1985 in the UK by vintage imprint Jonathan Tate. Over the decades, its power and resonance have grown exponentially. Certainly, that's in part thanks to Bruce Miller's remarkable television adaptation starring Elizabeth Moss, which began airing in 2017. There have always been questions from readers about The Handmaid's Tale, but they are now more urgent than ever. Margaret turns 80 in November this year, and it is 50 years. They told me to say. And it is 50 years since her first book, The Edible Woman, was published. She has since become a fully-fledged literary rock star, and The Testaments is the most anticipated literary event of the year. The Testaments has also been shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize, Margaret's sixth shortlisting, including a win for The Blind Assassin in the year 2000. So I will start with a few questions, the first of which is what prompted your return to Gilead 34 years after the publication of The Handmaid's Tale. And I wonder how much interest from readers has spurred you. As I said, there have always been questions about The Handmaid's Tale. And how much were you provoked by current events and real-world inspiration?
That's about 50 questions. Let's try to condense it a bit. First of all, yes, there had been many requests for a sequel, which I'd always said no to, because I understood it to mean that it would be a continuation of the narrative voice of Alfred in The Handmaid's Tale, and there was no way I could recreate that. However, as time moved on, and instead of moving further away from Gilead, we started moving towards it, particularly in the United States, I re-examined that position and decided that although I could not continue with the story of Alfred, I could continue with three other people concerned in these events and tell the story of the beginning of the end. Because we know from The Handmaid's Tale that Gilead vanishes. It's no longer present 200 years into the future because they're having a symposium on it. And we know that when they're having a symposium on something, it's done. It's over. So how did it collapse? How did these kinds of regimes disappear? And they can disappear in various ways. So I was interested in exploring that, and also in exploring what it would be like for the second generation. Because second generations in revolutionary regimes are quite different from first generation.
And it's all that they know.
That's all they know. That's normal life to them. But also they're not engaged in the violent part of the affair. A form of order has been restored. There's some way in which this thing functions. And that's what they grow up within. So one of the narrators grows up within Gilead. One of them grows up across the border in the place where you escape to when things go pear-shaped in the United States, and that would be Canada.
We're all ready to go.
It has always been that way. And therefore we see Gilead from within, from without, and from a founder.
But then that leads me to my next question, because one of these three narrators is Aunt Lydia.
Yes.
And why did this particular character stay with you, I wonder?
She's only seen from the outside in The Handmaid's Tale. We know she's a quoting type of person. She does not give up this habit in the Testaments. And the question always is with people in those kinds of positions in regimes, especially in regimes that are hierarchically arranged and in which they are by their nature never going to be top dog. So how do these people get into their positions of relative power? What do they use that power for? And what is their justification to themselves about why they're doing it? So as you might expect, having been born in 1939, I've always been very interested in these questions and have read quite a few journals of people who were recording events at the time, including the Diary of Goebbels. Also, we know from history that it's nothing new to have a person functioning with inside a regime, inside from within a regime, who is actually somewhat hostile to that regime. And I'm right now reading the big history of Thomas Cromwell that came out.
Dermot McCullough.
Yes. And Cromwell was one of these kinds of people. He was a Protestant evangelical secretly within the court of Henry VIII, who was death on Protestant evangelicals. And I do mean death. He killed him. So what do you think you're doing? And how do you justify to yourself, well, I have to kill these people because otherwise my other plans will not work out?
And I also want to ask how much your involvement in the television series, which now we've just seen the third season, yes, I think. How has that affected the way that you, if at all, embarked on this new book? Because, for instance, Baby Nicole,
yes,
is a character in this book, as, yes, she is, viewers will know,
yes,
Baby Nicole. So maybe, yes, talk a little bit about that.
So that was a name negotiation. Baby Nicole was my name. So Bruce Miller and I, we talk on the phone, and I read the scripts, I make notes on them. I don't have any actual power. I have, quotes, influence. So in my Thomas Cromwell position vis-a-vis the show, I have influence but no actual power. But luckily we are in accord most of the time. And when I said, you can't kill that person, he said, well, I wasn't going to anyway. When I said, hands off that baby, he said, oh, okay.
And is that because you knew that was maybe coming into this book?
Yes. So I couldn't tell him yet that it was in, but he has now read the book and is thrilled to have been given so much extra whiteboard space.
And so, J.R. Wyatt, do you consider the Testaments a dystopia? Could you talk about how you interpreted
that? Okay. A dystopia is an imagined society that we assume is worse than the one we live in. And a utopia is an imagined society that is better than the one we are living in. So the 19th century was the age of utopias. Huge numbers of them were produced because the 19th century felt that it was improving things. And it already improved a number of them, including vaccination and the sewer system. So the sky was the limit, and things would just keep on getting better. That's what they thought. And then that turned around the turn of the century. And after World War I, and particularly World War II, utopias became very hard to write, because let us not forget that a number of totalitarian and bloodletting societies started out as utopian propositions, including the USSR, including Nazi Germany and fascist Italy and Pol Pot's Cambodia and a whole bunch of other ones that we've seen since. So they always come in saying, we're going to make everything vastly better, except first we have to get rid of those people. There's usually a those people. So they became harder to write. Is the Handmaid's Tale plus the Testaments a dystopian world? Let us hope so, although it's never uniform. The people that are running things in those societies think that it's the vast improvement over what they were doing before because they're in a good position. What's your problem? So that's how it goes. Every dystopia contains within itself a little utopia, and every utopia contains within itself a little dystopia. Until the wall went down, until the Cold War ended, the United States was selling itself as the alternative to the Cold War evil empire. So they were the land of freedom, democracy, equality, the opportunity for all, and therefore they were not showcasing their shadow side, kept pretty firmly under wraps in those days. But once that opponent was gone, everything could come out of the cupboard.
Red Sail from Connect Radio. Like many print disabled readers, we're delighted that the book has been simultaneously published in audio. I noticed that you're down as one of the narrators and Sir Derek Jacobi as well. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how you selected the narrators for the various parts?
So audiobooks, it's a very interesting story, and I think the audience for audiobooks has been vastly increased by traffic jams. So this one was produced by Orly Moskowitz. So how they typically do it is she selects a number of voice clips of people that she thinks could do it, and she sends them to me, and I listen to them. And I say, this would be great, this one maybe not so much. How about this? And then she sees that those voice actors are available. And then they go in and read their parts in a studio. I appear on that audiobook. I think I do the chapter headings. So it's like that. We've done a number of them once publishers got on to the idea that audiobooks were a thing, you know, that people would actually listen to them. When they first appeared, they were CDs. But now, of course, you can download them and get subscriptions to them and do all sorts of things. This one has got 4 readers and 5 counting me.
Paul, well, just curious, you were just called a literary rock star, and following a little bit on that question about the attention this book is getting, are you overwhelmed by the launch of this thing?
Well, considering the lives that rock stars lead, I'm
well, you made it to almost 80s.
I know, I haven't yet, you know, died of an opiate overdose. not yet. There's time. Yes. I think that this kind of thing can be quite ruinous for a 35-year-old, because where do you go from there? In my case, we kind of know the answer. We know the plot. So am I overwhelmed by it? I'm very pleased and grateful to the readers who have stuck with me for all these years, and to the teams of people, both here and in the U.S. and Canada, the people who have been working an amazing number of hours putting it all together and trying to keep the lid on, because there were concerted efforts to try to steal the manuscript, which would have been used, I'm told, for fishing expeditions in which download the testaments and you click on it, you do the fatal click on the link, and then you get malware in your computer and all your information is in the hands of people who steal your identity. So that did not happen, so far as we know.
Sonia Elks at the Thompson Writers Foundation. You said that you felt that the United States was moving closer to the Gilead that you imagined. What has that been like for you, and do you have any hope or expectation that the testaments can have a relationship with reality in terms of offering a warning or a conversation?
If you look at the legislative moves made by a number of different states within the United States, you can see that some of them are almost there. But what these restrictive laws about women's bodies are claiming is that the state owns your body. There is a parallel occasion for men, and that would be the draft. So the draft or conscription, in which the state says this body is going to go into the war, but when they do that, they pay for your clothing, lodging, food, medical expenses, and they give you a salary. So I say unto them, if you want to conscript women's bodies in this way, you should pay for it. As it is, you're forcing women to deliver babies, it's enforced childbirth, and you're not paying for any of it. I think that's very cheap labor, and that's a con.
Do you see the sort of second part of the question, that the testaments having a kind of relationship?
I think it enters into a conversation that's already taking place, because The Handmaid's Tale has been a meme in these kinds of conversations for years. It was in the 2008 election, it was in the 2012 election, and it certainly was in the 2016 election. But for a society that claims to value individual freedom, I would say to them, evidently you don't think this individual freedom extends to women.
Barbara Schwinder from the German Public Radio. The testaments compared to The Handmaid's Tale is much more optimistic. So I was wondering, I think there's no reason to be more optimistic nowadays, so why did the tone in a way change?
The Handmaid's Tale is optimistic. Why is that? Because it ends, because they didn't kill off the central character, number one. And also we have the symposium at the end, which makes it clear that Gilead didn't last. So there's lots of reasons not to be optimistic, but about these kinds of regimes, there are frequently reasons to be optimistic because, in fact, they tend not to last. And it is the same with this one. We have another symposium in which our professor spends quite a lot of time talking about whether they are authentic manuscripts or not and how come we didn't find them before and all of those things that academics talk about. But it is still clear that Gilead is over and it crumbled partly from within.
Deborah Bonetti, you join on Italian Daily Newspaper. I was wondering, the Testaments has been described as more accessible in terms of writing than the original Handmaid's Tale. I just wonder whether you agree and whether the accessible look of the new book is informed by the fact that you know that there is a much bigger readership coming towards it because of the TV series, whether you thought of that at all, and whether you wanted to reach out more.
No. I think that The Handmaid's Tale is a single narrator book, and it was also and everything has to be laid out in it through a narrator who doesn't know very much. Hence we have a symposium 200 plus years later in which the people giving the symposium know a lot more than the narrator of the book. She can't know because she's not allowed access to documents and reading materials, and she also can't know because of her position in the society, which is very constrained. So a single narrator who isn't allowed to do much is going to be very inner monologue and very meditative and very tense, which is what it is. This one has three narrators, and one of them knows a lot. Like, she really knows a lot. She knows a J. Edgar Hoover lot. And she also knows a Thomas Cromwell under Henry VIII lot. They all did the same things. They collected dirt on people, which they then used in manipulative ways, as one does in those positions. And we have another narrator who also knows quite a lot because she took it at school and did a paper on it. So I don't think that I was intending to have it be, quote, more accessible. I always try to write in a way that's clear. So I wasn't intentionally being, quote, more accessible for any of the reasons that you mentioned. The choices had entirely to do with the realities of the world and the realities of the characters. I do tend to write short chapters, but I've always written short chapters. And that has to do with the fact that I do not have a court-lined room like Proust, and I don't have people bringing me my breakfast on a tray every day like characters in Henry James's fiction. So I get interrupted a lot. How can I put this? Lots to see and do every day. therefore my writing time gets shoved either into the early morning or into the night these days.
The Testaments by Margaret Atwood is available now from the RNIB Library in Braille, giant print, and as TB24921. For more information on this and all the books featured in this week's show, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Now it's back to Elif Shafak to hear the books of her life. Elif, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become a writer?
I think books have played a huge role in my childhood, also because I was an only child and books really were my friends. But more than just a single book, perhaps a writer was very important to me. After I discovered his work, I tried to read everything that I could find of him in Turkish, and that was Charles Dickens. And interestingly, at the time, several of Charles Dickens' novels had been translated into Turkish and published as graphic novels. So to me, that was very interesting. Discovering him, particularly A Tale of Two Cities, at the time, left a huge impact on me.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received, for good or for evil, in the superlative degree of comparison only. There were a king with a large jaw and a queen with a plain face on the throne of England. There were a king with a large jaw and a queen with a fair face on the throne of France. In both countries, it was clearer than crystal to the lords of the state preserves of loaves and fishes that things in general were settled forever.
A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB14956, narrated by Anton Lesser. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I have realized over the years that many, many times I went back to Orlando, Virginia Woolf's Orlando, and I think it's one of those very special books that needs to be revisited. And every time you read it, you enjoy it in a different way. One thing I associate that particular novel with is freedom. It makes me feel free. Until I read Orlando, I didn't know it was possible to write a story like that with such freedom, that you could really, really transcend all boundaries, national boundaries, but also boundaries of time, geography, gender. So I think I associate Virginia Woolf's Orlando with freedom.
He, for there could be no doubt of his sex, though the fashion of the time did something to disguise it, was in the act of slicing at the head of a Moor which swung from the rafters. It was the colour of an old football, and more or less the shape of one, save for the sunken cheeks and a strand or two of coarse, dry hair, like the hair on a coconut. Orlando's father, or perhaps his grandfather, had struck it from the shoulders of a vast pagan who had started up under the moon in the barbarian fields of Africa, and now it swung gently, perpetually, in the breeze which never ceased blowing through the attic rooms of the gigantic house of the lord who had slain him.
Orlando by Virginia Woolf is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB9833. It's narrated by Norma West. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
You know, at the moment I'm reading John Day's new book, homing, and it's beautiful. It's a beautifully written story about pigeons, actually, but it's at the same time about so much more, about home, what exactly home means, belonging, perhaps non-belonging, written with a lot of heart. So it's a book with a big heart, and I would definitely recommend it.
After being loaded onto the lorry, the pigeons were driven north through the night. They were supposed to arrive by Thursday evening, but the lorry broke down on the way up, and so it wasn't until Friday that the convoyer finally reached the Liberation Point, a nondescript car park on the east bank of the River Thurso, at the end of the A9, in the northernmost town in Britain. 1,000 or so pigeons were competing in the 2018 Thurso Classic, one of the longest and most prestigious pigeon races in the club calendar. My six birds would be flying with them. The Liberation Point was 504 miles to their home loft in my garden in East London. But pigeons rarely fly as the crow does, choosing instead to follow low-lying land and avoiding large bodies of open water, and so the distance they would travel would likely be far greater. With a following wind, they might fly at 50 miles per hour, and would be able to cover the distance in 12 hours or so. But Thurso was famously unpredictable, and it was the hottest race day anyone could remember. It would probably take them far longer to home, if they made it back on the day at all.
Homing, On Pigeons, Dwellings and Why We Return, written by John Day, is available commercially in print, ebook and audio, which is narrated by Matt Addis. Ella Shafak, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.